Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Washington, D.C.
Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Welcome to the Freedom Report. First, a message from our sponsors. The Libertarian Republic is brought to you in part by Amagi Metals. Amagi Metals is TLR's trusted metals dealer, and their mission is to help simplify the buying process of metals while illuminating the importance of financial responsibility and sound money. So, if you've been thinking about getting into metals, go to amagimetals.com and check them out. That's amagimetals.com. During the month of February, enjoy discounts and silver giveaways to commemorate Amagi's 4-year anniversary. Check out amagimetals.com anniversary. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are here in Washington, D.C., the Students for Liberty Conference. I'm here with my buddy Dan D'Amico. He is the Assistant Professor of Economics at Loyola University in New Orleans. Dan, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Austin. It's good to see you again.
It's good to see you, too. So, Dan, what are you working on these days? What are your major projects?
The interesting thing about my research is that my project never goes away. Mostly I work on mass incarceration, How to understand what contributes and causes the new modern American phenomenon of mass incarceration. So it's a multifaceted project. I do a lot of stuff with history, how different societies around the world and over time have utilized different punishment mechanisms, and how some of them have converged on imprisonment as a particular form of criminal justice enforcement. But then also because in the last 20 to 30 years, we've gotten a lot more and a lot better international data on prison populations and different types of crime. I have a bit of an empirical project going on right now where we're using what's called the colonial origins categories, whether or not nations are common versus civil law in their historical foundation and the organizational structure of their legal system, and how that affects their prison populations.
Okay. One of the things libertarians will have a big debate on is the role of privatization in prisons. What's your take on prison privatization? Should we privatize more prisons?
I have a paper on this, actually, called The Business Ethics of Incarceration. Basically, I think that a lot of people think that prison privatization is the essence of mass incarceration, that it's
the cause of it.
And I don't think that there's good evidence for that,
right?
First off, there's very few private prison facilities relative to the massive outgrowth. But I think that the unique explanatory power of the classical liberal tradition, especially in public choice economics and Austrian economics, what we have is the ability to recognize that all of the complaints of people who point to prison privatization, all of the activists who are saying they're making money off of high crime, they're profiting off of other people's misery, they're kind of right. And the thing about it is that they're also right about prisons that are funded and managed by the state. It is still the same incentive structure. If you work for the government, you're getting a paycheck based on this process of criminalization. So prison labor unions is one of the largest remnant union labor pools in the country. There's nurses, there's teachers, there's prison guards. They represent a significant voting block. That voting block is likely to support get tough on crime policies, prison expansion, increased budgets for domestic militarization regarding criminal justice enforcement. Those are incentives we should also be concerned with just as much as a private corporation doing it. The empirical literature on privatization basically shows that the first experiments were touch and go. Early privatizations led to some prison riots because the way you economized, the way you made profits as a private company was to cut the labor force.
Right.
And inmates just weren't used to that. They saw it as an opportunity. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing about private companies is that they can learn. Mm-hmm. And you can constrain them with contracts. So there is a little bit of a better feedback mechanism that takes place in private prison companies relative to public prison companies. So the anecdote is that you get what you contract for. Mm-hmm. Your private prison company in a state is only going to be as good as the governor is sort of looking at it and paying attention to it and monitoring it.
One of the problems that people say with privatization is they say, well, if you have a profit incentive, you want more incarcerations. Is that true?
It is true. And the issue, though, is that the profit incentive is also at play in the public sector. So that's not a unique feature of privatization per se. Bruce Benson has a lot of really good work on this. He's a public choice economist from Florida State University, and it's a critical component of what we call public choice economics. We refer to it as behavioral symmetry. Any of the behavioral assumptions like self-interest, profit seeking that we assume about private actors, we should also assume about public actors. Politicians are in it to win it. They want to get reelected. They want to get votes. They want to finance constituencies. They want to curry favor with the electorate. That's true. Mm-hmm. Also, when you have a public prison system, mm-hmm. what I think is really interesting in the intersection between something like Keynesian macroeconomic stimulus and prison privatization, or even just prison expansion, mm-hmm. whether it's public or private. What you have is a very convenient arena of both capital and labor investment. It's a shovel-ready job program. So when you're trying to resolve problems like unemployment, or when you're trying to resolve problems like underproduction in a macro recession like we have right now, it's an easy avenue to spend money in that's going to put people to work right away.
Now, one of the programs that I've heard comes from the UK is this incentive that they give to prisons, where they give them an incentive for a reduced recidivation rate, which is, for our listeners who may not know, basically it's an incentive for prisons who have less people coming back in going into jail. Recidivation means, you know, how many people are actually coming back and committing more crimes and coming back into jail. Do you think that that's a good incentive? That, like, if the state is going to have private prisons, that the incentive should be on having less people coming back into jail?
So that's sort of one of the benefits of a potential privatization model. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think the word privatization is an appropriate term for what we see in the for-profit prison sector, because really what you're talking about is contracting out.
Right.
A truly private property system gives the owner and the operator a leniency, an ability to determine the margins it operates on.
Mm-hmm.
But private prisons don't have the authority to determine what they incarcerate for, mm-hmm. right? They can't say, well, we're not going to incarcerate for drugs, or we're going to do X, Y, and Z. It's only the terms of the contract that the state puts together.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have here is an example of something good in the political process that, mm-hmm. that informed political leaders to say, well, we're going to put this in the contract that we actually want these people to lower the crime rate. That's only going to work insofar as your political process makes your political leaders accountable, which is problematic. It's a bad feedback process, right? We bundle issue space. We get stuck with people for long periods of time. There's a status quo bias. I mean, any number of things that make politics inefficient would also matriculate into the way in which we operate criminal justice services.
Mm-hmm. One of the words that gets whispered around conferences like this is the big scary A word, is anarchy. Uh-huh. And when they look from the outside in at libertarianism, they think anarchy. They think people are going to burn down the government, and it's, you know, violent, or they think about the people who shot Franz Ferdinand and McKinley, and that's what they, you know, or the people who are firebombing trade conferences. But libertarians, they have a brand of anarchy. They call it anarcho-capitalism. Mm-hmm. They say that this is a peaceful philosophy. But when you talk about where the rubber meets the road, and they specifically talk about imprisoning, you think about if we had a private judicial, you know, private courts, and we had private prisons, you know, if you were a libertarian, or maybe if you were an anarchist in an anarchist society, or Ancapistan, however you would call it, could you say, hey, if somebody steals your goat, could you lock them in their, you know, lock them in the basement, you know, as an individual? Like, how do you administer justice in a sense that provides for the common good?
So I like that you're asking the right question. Most people who are interested in anarchism would tend to ask, what is the legitimacy, or what would be justice? I think Instead, a lot of my research isn't so much concerned with anarchism for the sake of activism. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned with anarchism because I want to study and understand statelessness. Mm-hmm. How is it that people actually resolve these types of problems? So one of my projects is looking at different social environments, different contexts, primitive societies, ancient societies, underground societies, criminal networks, international trade, online communities, etc., and asking, well, these are environments where the state is conveniently absent, and so are all of its technologies of enforcement, including incarceration. So the processes of conflict resolution that take place in those environments tend to be different, functional, and spontaneous order in their origins, which means that they have an adaptive quality that tends to work pretty well. Basically, stateless environments are bad at one thing, which is defending themselves against invading states. So most places that don't have states don't have prisons, and they have to utilize mechanisms like restitution, civil tort procedures, things that look like private law, in order to enforce contracts and resolve disputes and build trust and reputation over time. Now, it's difficult to imagine how we could just switch and convert our contemporary system to something like that, but it's not to say that those things are impossible. And I do think that there's a great potential in converting lots of the criminal justice system over to at least the contemporary civil court process.
What are some of the best historic examples that we could point to of statelessness that people could study if they wanted more information?
Well, I have a paper in the journal Public Choice about the rise of incarceration in the ancient Athenian Empire. And what's interesting about that case is that prior to the city-state of Athens, you had a relatively stateless environment of ancient Greece. Different tribal city, sort of tribal communities isolated from one another, competing with one another for citizens and engaged in like fractional conflict. As Athens grows into an expansion and interventionist empire, they invent incarceration, in large part because of the things that you pointed out before, like if you're a private individual, how do you afford to like keep somebody in your basement who's aggressed against you or something? There was a process of indentured servitude prior to the Athenian Empire, and then that significantly gets taken over by the state, monopolized, and they invent incarceration. And my argument is that that invention actually dominoes and instigates an entire process of legal restructuring that basically explains the rise of the empire and its inevitable decline. In other words, the enforcement power provided by prisons gives the state an ability to tax higher rates, rejigger the monetary system, define property rights in ways that it never had the ability to do before, which gives them leverage to do forced conscription, launch unnecessary wars, etc. All of that is preceded in historical time by incarceration. Other examples of really interesting stateless environments include contemporary criminal networks. Peter Leeson's work on pirates is fascinating. David Skarbek is writing a book right now, coming out with Cambridge University Press. It's going to be huge. Everybody should buy it immediately when it comes out. It's all about inmate social orders, how it is that prison gangs come up with their own forms of constitutions, regulations, and interpersonal conflict resolution. Like criminals, the worst people in our society, the people who you would be scared to have a conversation with, have figured out ways to resolve conflict without recourse to the state. Our political leaders can't figure out this. Yeah. I mean, it's
well, the Australians, you know, they had the same thing. They were a bunch of convicts, and they somehow managed to create a social order.
There's a lot of really cool history about that. Norval Morris was one of the preeminent prison historians in the United States for a long while. He died recently, but his last book is actually historical fiction, and it's a romance story about the daughter of the like prison official who was in Van Diemen's Island, which is Tasmania today. It was actually the prison for prisoners, right? So once you got sent to Australia, they still needed a way to isolate people who were heinous and violent once they're there. Mm-hmm. And they got sent to Van Diemen's Island, and the guy was kind of hands-off. He was a pretty laissez-faire dude, and they were in it for the long haul in Australia. So he saw it as a necessity to figure out civil society norms, ways of governing the behavior that didn't involve totalitarian rules and top-down approaches. And so, I mean, it's fiction, like I said. It's sort of like this bizarre little romance story. Mm-hmm. But it's revealing that the world's preeminent prison historian chooses to represent the Australian penal colony experience in such a romantic light.
Interesting. All right. Well, this is Dan D'Amico. Thank you very much for talking about private prisons today. Really appreciate you joining the show.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Austin.